On the program today, the election and this economy, short to medium term. A reminder that the virus is the economy for now, and a story about how money that just complicates everything. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 11th day of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It can be good, I think, to revisit and perhaps reconsider predictions made about the short and medium-term economic future. So that is where we will begin today. A couple of weeks ago, before Election Day, we talked to Wendy Edelberg. She is the director of the Hamilton Project, also a senior fellow at Brookings, about how the presidential election, or weeks of counting ballots or contested results, might affect this economy and where it's going. So now that we're on the other side, we got her back on the phone. Hey, Wendy, welcome back to the program.
Very good to talk to you, Kai.
Well, here we are in the future of which we spoke 3.5 weeks ago. We have a winner in the presidential election, although the president and his party are refusing to admit that. I wonder, as you read the economic tea leaves now, how you're feeling.
I'm certainly feeling better in that it looks like some of the worst outcomes that folks feared are off the table with regards to the immense uncertainty that we might be experiencing post-election. And some of the economic news that we've gotten since we last spoke has been more positive. So that makes me feel better. But there's, of course, still a lot of economic pain out there, and I still very much want policymakers to act with urgency to do more to support this economy.
It will not come as news to you that politicians in Washington are not exhibiting that urgency. And in fact, to the degree that they're talking about more relief for this economy, they are talking, at least Senator Mitch McConnell is, who will, in theory, have the deciding vote in the Senate. He is talking on the smaller end rather than the larger.
What's frustrating about these discussions about how large a package should be is that policymakers have it completely within their power to have the size of the package be hinged on the state of the economy. So they can set expansions and extensions of unemployment insurance benefits, for example, hinged on the state of the labor market and have them draw down automatically as the labor market improves. So if both sides are in disagreement as to how strong the labor market is, that doesn't mean that they can't agree on a package if they just make the package contingent on the labor market.
What do you suppose this economy looks like if, and I'm sorry to go back to the size thing again, but I, for as much as I value your expertise, I don't see them actually doing the thing that you just talked about, you know, making it contingent upon the health of the economy. What happens in this economy if a relief package is on the smaller size?
If it's on the smaller side and then they're incredibly nimble to be able to come back later and do something again if more is needed, then that isn't the worst of all possible outcomes, but that's probably not the world you anticipate either. If it's too small, no, we're in big trouble. We have 10.5 million people who don't have jobs, who used to have jobs. That's insanity. We have lost sight of what economic pain looks like. And with each passing week, the permanent scarring effects of this economic pain is going to get worse.
Just to circle back to the thing you started with, which is that, you know, uncertainty is generally speaking down given the results of the election. Do you think the economy, and I understand that I'm anthropomorphizing here, but do you think the economy is doing what President-elect Biden is doing with what President Trump and Republicans are doing, which is in essence saying, nothing to see here. Move along. Everything's going to work out. Right? The economy's just kind of cranking on.
I think that puts too much emphasis on the fact that there are really bad events that we worried about that look like they're off the table. And yes, that should all make us breathe a sigh of relief. But when 10.5 million people are without jobs and small business revenue is down 25%, that's like hair on fire, screaming down the street, panic-inducing, which I would argue, I do argue, is the opposite of nothing to see here.
Yeah, I think you have just argued that, actually, quite successfully. Wendy Edelberg is the director of the Hamilton Project, also senior fellow in economic studies at Brookings. Wendy, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Wall Street on this Wednesday was kind of mixed. Tech stocks did have a good day, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You know this already, I'm sure, because the news is pretty much everywhere, but the virus is spiking pretty much everywhere. And hearing the actual numbers is kind of staggering. According to the COVID tracking project, that's from The Atlantic, there were more than 130,000 new cases of the disease yesterday. It's been a week now of more than 100,000 a day, and almost 62,000 new COVID hospitalizations just yesterday. As Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, that has created a supply chain problem. Not enough for deeply overworked caregivers in the healthcare supply chain.
Back in the spring, when COVID-19 hospitalizations were surging in a handful of cities, medical personnel from across the country packed up and traveled to hotspots to help. But now, as cases surge to all-time highs in many states,
the problem is the country itself is almost one big hotspot.
That's Dave Dillon with the Missouri Hospital Association. In Missouri, hospital beds are almost full.
And our biggest issue currently is staffing. We have bed capacity, but beds are only as good as your ability to put the staffing resource beside them.
Some hospitals are short-staffed because their own people are sick or quarantining. Or in some places, there just wasn't enough staff to begin with, says Cynthia Cox with the Kaiser Family Foundation.
That's particularly acute in rural areas where it's just harder to attract the workforce that hospitals need.
University of Iowa epidemiologist Christine Peterson says in her state, rural hospitals are sending patients to the already strapped larger hospitals. So COVID care at those facilities is partly provided by
people who are trained for other things, not specialists in these areas of pulmonary care or infectious diseases.
Getting reassigned worries Lisa Ford. She's a nurse at the hospital system affiliated with Washington University in St. Louis. Like many of her colleagues, she has a child at home who she's helping with remote learning.
I feel like people are just, they're tired. They're worn down. It just feels relentless. It feels never ending. It's frustrating.
And cases are rising in Missouri. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Apple gets a lot of attention for its design aesthetic. Everything is so smooth and sleek and functional, right? And millions and millions and millions of us have bought into it. But the company's got a lot going on under the hood as well. It's got its own operating systems. It created its own processors for the iPhones. And now it's dumping its partnership with chip behemoth Intel to go it alone in the laptop and desktop market. Apple introduced the first Macs to feature the house brand yesterday, a chip known as M1, designed by Apple itself. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab explains it's all about power, of the computing kind, also of the industry kind.
Apple's goal has always been to set itself apart from PCs. Maybe you remember these ads.
Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC.
You may begin.
PC, why is there a referee here?
To make sure you play fair, Mac, so you don't go...
Technically, Macs have always been personal computers, but with Apple's software. Add in Apple's own chip. Neil Seibert is an analyst with Above Avalon, a research firm that focuses on Apple.
And that kind of starts to get into more of almost the secret sauce that Apple has right here, and that is being able to control both the hardware and software.
Nick Santanam at McKinsey says Apple controls only about 10% of the personal computer market. But making its own chip is about much more than making a better computer. It's about creating yet one more reason for Apple users to stay with the mothership.
The device is a Trojan horse to get you into the ecosystem and hold on to the ecosystem.
With the new chip, apps will work across devices. So your iPhone becomes your MacBook and your MacBook becomes your iPhone.
It gives you literally an extension of your products end to end. And by definition, the consumer and the customers have access to the ecosystem in an identical way.
It's hard to know how this will impact the rest of the computer market. Julie Osk with Forrester says Apple usually sets the tone. Other computer makers may be influenced, but
I don't think there is a catching up.
She says other companies don't have the money to invest in chip development, so they may push the things that make people die-hard PC owners, like affordability, program integration, and a right click on the mouse. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Should you find yourself with a need for business and economic news early in the morning every weekday, Marketplace Morning Report is where you should go. Check them out. Coming up.
We should think about just having the ceremony, but not legally getting married until you've paid off your debt.
Ouch. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial down 23 today, less than a 10%, closed at 29,397. The NASDAQ gained 232 points, 2%, finished at 11,786. Did the NASDAQ, the S&P 500, picked up 27.7 tenths%, ended things at about 35.72. Tech shares, as I said, rebounded. Netflix packed on 2.1%. Microsoft up 2.6%. Apple, that Kristen Schwab was talking about, gained 3% today. Chipotle on Saturday is going to open its first digital orders-only restaurant. No dining room, no in-person, nothing. Suburban NYC is where it is, by the way. Third quarter, Chipotle's digital sales more than tripled. That explains that. Today, shares rose 4.9%. The recovery in restaurant jobs was slowing dramatically even before the current surge in virus cases, by the way. The National Restaurant Association says staffing levels remained 2.1 million jobs below pre-virus levels. The association reports that as of September, more than 100,000 restaurants and bars have closed permanently. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. 8 months ago today, March the 11th, this pandemic became tangible. Tom Hanks announced he had COVID. Remember that? The NBA postponed its season, and President Trump made that Oval Office speech. Not long after that, the CARES Act passed, and businesses started applying for the Paycheck Protection Program, those forgivable loans that were a key part of the government's response. Marketplace's Justin Ho has been on this story the whole time, and he has checked in with a couple of businesses that got PPP money to see how things have been going.
Back in April, optometrist David McBride had to shut down his vision clinic in Portland, Oregon. When he reopened it 7 weeks later,
we were paying staff with really no revenue coming in because we had 7 weeks of no billing.
But by then, McBride had received a $54,000 PPP loan. That money helped him pay staff and make rent after the clinic reopened.
It was a lifeline for us as we got started up and running again. And so it would have been very difficult to get where we're at right now without that little influx of capital.
Now, McBride says about 70% of his business has returned. His next step is getting his loan forgiven, which was part of the original plan for the program. He's confident that his business meets the requirements for forgiveness, but he hasn't applied yet. His loan was just a little too big. Businesses that took out less than $50,000 can use a simpler forgiveness form. But those rules could always change.
I'm just hoping for kind of a general forgiveness so I don't have to do any more paperwork.
His accountant, Laurelyn Wilson, says she's been telling many of her clients to wait and see if Congress will make the process any easier.
People are just like, can I apply now? Can I apply now? Is it deductible? Is it simple? That's pretty much it.
Not all PPP recipients have been as lucky. Wilson says some of her clients, including restaurant and bar owners, are still struggling, especially now that COVID-19 cases are on the rise.
So in terms of keeping their doors open, the PPP loan forgiveness has kind of taken a backseat to that.
And for some PPP recipients, keeping the doors open just hasn't been possible.
The PPP loan was something that gave us a runway, but it didn't solve the problem.
Emmeline Zhao is a partner at Little Tong Noodle Shop in Midtown Manhattan.
It couldn't control for the fact that consumers just weren't purchasing or going out.
Most offices in the neighborhood are still closed. Her PPP loan did help the restaurant reopen in May. But then Zhao started to realize that the numbers just weren't adding up.
That's just the very, very difficult conclusion that you have to come to, is that if you can't cover overhead, then unfortunately the business has to shutter.
Last month, the restaurant's PPP money ran dry, and Little Tong Noodle Shop shut its doors for good. Zhao says, as painful as that was, and as corny as this sounds,
it's the circle of life, and we can't be upset about it because, you know, we just figure out how to come out of this stronger.
Zhao is hopeful the restaurant will reopen at some point in the future, but she doesn't see that happening for at least another year. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Listeners of a certain age might remember back in the day buying and collecting and trading sports cards. It was baseball for me. It used to be real popular, kind of fell out of favor, but now apparently is back. Turns out it's yet another unexpected side effect of the pandemic. And as more people are collecting, the value of certain cards is skyrocketing. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst explains how all this happened.
Ken Golden, a collectible card auctioneer, remembers back in May auctioning off a 2009 autographed Mike Trout baseball card. In case you don't know, he's a center fielder for the Los Angeles Angels and frequent league MVP.
Prior to the pandemic, I would have expected the card to go for about $500,000. The card went for $922,500.
At the time, it was a record for the highest-priced modern trading card. Golden says he's since broken that record 7 times. According to the site SportsCollectorsDaily.com, compared to last year, baseball card sales were up more than 50% on eBay, March through May. Professor List at the University of Chicago studies behavioral economics through the baseball card market.
The sports card market's doing well right now, I believe, because it's part nostalgic, part art, in part investment potential. Add to that fact that everyone has been cooped up at home and longing for the good old days, and you make a very special market moment.
But can it last? Card collecting was popular in the 80s and 90s. What happened then is a case study in supply and demand. Jason Howarth is a VP of marketing of Panini America, the world's largest sports and collectibles company.
You know, the manufacturers back then overproduced the product, which basically devalued it. You know, trading cards are built on scarcity.
He says since then, manufacturers have learned their lesson. So maybe this is a winning streak that will continue even after the pandemic. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Money can make things difficult, you know? It can happen in the workplace. Who makes how much? It can happen between friends. You owe me money, man. And it can happen in relationships because people come with different expectations and habits around money. And sometimes it's easier to just not talk about it. But when you hide things like a bank account or debts or purchases, what happens is something called financial infidelity. And it is way more common than you'd think. According to the Harris poll, more than 40% of Americans have hidden some kind of financial decision from their partners. Rima Kreis, the host of our podcast, This is Uncomfortable, has the cost of one woman's money secret.
It was the summer of 1999, and Jordan Rosenfeld remembers her fiancé coming home one night with some gossip from work.
He was sharing it thinking, like, we were both going to go, like, oh, whoa, together, you know, be shocked and awed together.
He told her that his coworker's wife was apparently hiding credit card debt.
She had like $7,000 on he didn't know about.
Jordan just sat on the couch, nodding along. But inside, she froze.
And I said, well, I also have debt. that I haven't told you about, and it's more than that.
Her fiancé, Eric, tensed up. His whole demeanor quickly changed.
I knew it was touching a hot button for him because he's very clean with money. Security is really important to him in a financial sense.
Eric asked her, well, how much is it? It was $14,000 of credit card debt.
I felt ashamed and horrified, but there was also kind of a relief in knowing the truth, you know? Like, here it is. You can't hide from it.
But that truth did not sit well with her fiancé.
He said something like, you know, debt is like living in the past, and you can't move into the future if you are living in the past.
And what happened next felt like a punch to the gut. Their wedding was a month away, and Eric told her, I'm grateful you told me about this secret, but...
But, you know, I just feel like, I feel like we should think about just having the ceremony, but not legally getting married until you've paid off your debt.
Eric wasn't ready to link their financial futures. He didn't want to talk for this story, but to Jordan, it felt like he'd put one foot out the door.
You know, like, I didn't feel like I could argue with him because I was the one with the debt and I was the one with the secret.
For Jordan, the money secrets started early. Growing up, her parents struggled financially and her dad sold pot to make ends meet. Even talking about money in the house felt shameful. And when she entered her first serious relationship, she dated someone who controlled her spending. In her early 20s, when she finally got out of that relationship, she took out her very first credit card.
It was like a gleaming silver beacon of freedom, you know, like, this is so exciting. This is so dangerous.
Eventually, she took out two more credit cards and just started spending. And each month, she'd tuck away the statements in her closet. It was right about then, as her debt was quietly mounting, when she started dating Eric. And what did your debt represent to you?
To me, it represented like my failure to be honest, my failure to take care of myself as an adult in the world.
But after she confessed that night on the couch, for days, things felt tense between them. They still had plans for a wedding ceremony, though. And to go over last-minute details, they met with the Buddhist priest who was going to marry them. And they told her about their idea to hold off on getting legally married.
And she, like, stops. And she's like, if you want to join, you know, futures with this woman, then you either have to do it or don't do it. Like, there's no halfway.
In that moment, Jordan looked over at Eric.
I could see the gears turning behind his eyes. He grabbed my hand and he kind of pulled me closer to him. I could feel the tension leave both of our bodies in that room.
In the end, they got married, legally. People hide money for all sorts of reasons. They're ashamed, or they want to feel like they're in control, or maybe they just want to be the person their partner thinks they are.
There's just no shame in asking for help, but for some reason, when you have a secret like that, all you feel is shame. And yet it's like on the other side, you realize how much help you needed, you know?
Yeah, with her husband's help, she ended up paying off that $14,000. And she is now officially debt-free. I'm Rima Khreis for Marketplace.
You can hear an extended version of Jordan's story by subscribing to This Is Uncomfortable. It is, of course, available on your favorite podcast app. This final note on the way out today, in which New York once again becomes a coronavirus bellwether. And you'll notice I put a question mark on the end of that because who knows what other states are going to do. But starting Friday night in the Empire State, no more gatherings of big groups. Max is going to be 10 people at private residences. Restaurants and bars and other establishments with liquor licenses are going to have to shut down at 10 p.m. Takeout and delivery are still allowed. Food only, though. No booze. All right, we got to go, but here is your midweek moment of economic context, unintended consequences division. The Department of Energy was out with a new forecast this week showing coal use in this economy is expected to go up next year, providing 25% of all power generation. That is up from 20% this year. How come, you ask? Higher than expected natural gas prices. the market being the market, the lower priced commodity is always going to win. Long term, though, cleaner natural gas still wins out. Our media production team is Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. They're the ones coming into the studio so the rest of us don't have to, unless your home internet is terrible. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.